Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, it's hard to believe, but in just over 3 weeks, this election will be over. Unless, of course, we get a repeat of Florida from 2000 or something like that. But Election Day is just 3 weeks from tomorrow. And we talked last week about how the national poll numbers were now slightly in Mitt Romney's favor. He's doing better in state poll numbers. And now the Electoral College math is coming into play. Obviously, there are still two more debates and plenty of other things that could influence where this race ends up. But they've been doing the math. They've been sharing their internal polling. And you've been running the numbers that right now looks like they're getting close, but they still need a little bit of work to do. But it's still looking better than it was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I have a piece on the homepage on National Review Online. And the editors had said, well, if Romney doesn't win Ohio, and it's worth noting that he's looking better in Ohio right now, and the campaign is telling certain conservative reporters that their internal polling has Ohio dead even, which is obviously better than it's been. I think, you know, everybody on the right probably ought to keep in mind that dead even doesn't mean you're going to win. Dead even means you got a chance of winning.
Right.
And I'd very much prefer to see Romney with a lead in Ohio. And I actually think that if he does build a lead in Ohio as a result of the debate this week or for whatever reason, at that point, this is a very different race. And then you can genuinely say that Romney is favored. The reason I say that is you go through the map. At this point, it's actually pretty easy to get Romney to about 261 electoral votes, which is obviously only 9 less than he needs. Now, take people kind of through that. You may remember the Suffolk pollster said that he was no longer going to conduct surveys in North Carolina, Florida, and Virginia because he thought those states were already in the bag for Romney, and he wanted to turn his attention to more interesting states. And, you know, when he announced that, this was on Bill O'Reilly's show probably Tuesday night of last week, everybody kind of thought that was at least premature, if not crazy. I mean, North Carolina, okay, yeah, that's plausible. It's a pretty Republican state. Florida, maybe, and Virginia had looked, you know, fairly strong for Obama until recently. Well, since then, in Virginia, it's now up to 5 of the last 7 polls have Romney up, and one on Friday afternoon had Romney up by 7 percentage points. And in Florida, I believe it's now 4 of 6, and the Tampa Bay Times poll had Romney up by 7. So both of those states appear to be shifting to Romney. Not quite enough to put them totally in the bag for Romney yet, but that's obviously heading in the right direction pretty strongly. Now, the other two states that I find pretty interesting are New Hampshire. Only 2 polls conducted since the debates. One has a tie. The other one has Romney up by 4. I really wish we had more data in this state, but it now is starting to look like, okay, New Hampshire is a state that's always had a – it was anti-Bush sentiment that really drove the Obama win in New Hampshire 4 years ago. And so it seems like this is a state that's grown more tired of Obama. And then you got Colorado, which I had thought was going to be fairly difficult for the Romney campaign, a deep purple state, you might say. And the polling's actually looked pretty good for him out there. So you look at that, you add all those up, that gets you to 261 if you throw in all the McCain states, Indiana, the Nebraska elector who went for Obama last time around. You put that all there, all them up, you get 261. The problem is, if you don't get Ohio, for Romney, he's got to win Wisconsin, which, you know, looking closer, but I don't think we can put that safely in the Romney column yet, even with Paul Ryan on the ticket. Or he's got to win both Iowa and Nevada. Both of those states, things are looking better for Mitt Romney there, but I think he's still trailing. Both winnable, but you don't like having these, you know, outside triple bank shots where you need everything to go your way. Now, obviously, look, certain polls in Michigan look good for Romney with only a small Obama lead. Certain polls in Pennsylvania look pretty good. If either one of those were to flip into the Romney column, this is a whole new ballgame. If either one of those states flip, you'll see Ohio flip too. Ohio has always just been a slightly more Republican state than those other two neighboring Midwestern states. So the overall outlook for the Romney campaign is looking pretty good. And they just need, you know, keep this momentum and maybe one more big state to slip into their pile. And at that point, you know, he's above 270, and maybe you can start building a cushion with some of these bigger states.
It's math, Jim. It's arithmetic. So that's what, it's looking a lot easier. It was differential equations a few weeks ago, and now we're just looking at simple adding and subtracting. So hopefully that trend continues. You mentioned Pennsylvania. Our bad martini today, as most people are probably aware by now, the death over the weekend of former Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, and there may be some out there saying, well, let's not extol that career too much, and Jim and I will both more than happily say that we're glad Pat Toomey won that seat and not Arlen Specter or Joe Sestak in 2010. There's plenty to obviously frown at in Specter's career, his jumping on the anti-Bork train, his party switching at the end, his support of Obamacare, most famously for me, his embrace of Scottish law for exonerating President Clinton. But Jim, in his 30 years in the Senate, he did do some good things. He chaired pretty effectively, I thought, the confirmation hearings for both Chief Justice Roberts and Sam Alito. And most famously, he was extremely effective in devastating the accusations launched against Clarence Thomas in 1991 by Anita Hill. Here's a couple of clips from that very memorable hearing, which is hard to believe is now 21 years ago. First is Specter interrogating Anita Hill, and then is a very interesting exchange between three of the senators on the committee.
In fact, he never did ask you to have sex, correct?
No, he did not ask me to have sex.
You are not now drawing a conclusion that Judge Thomas sexually harassed you.
Yes, I am drawing that conclusion. That
well,
is
then
my...
I don't understand.
Pardon me?
Then I don't understand. Well, what am I missing here, Professor Hill?
The witness speaking her own words rather than having words put in her mouth?
Mr. Chairman, I object to that. I object to that vociferously. I'm asking questions here. If Senator Kennedy has anything to say, let him participate in this hearing.
That extremely eloquent man at the end banging the gavel and stumbling and bumbling through his words was Committee Chairman Joe Biden. So it's clear that he's advanced over the years. Jim, it's a story that darn near cost Arlen Specter his Senate seat in 1992, but it's definitely his moment that conservatives will remember most fondly.
Yeah, a good way of just summing up Arlen Specter is that when he was against you, you couldn't stand him. And when he was on your side, you were really glad he was on your side. You know, there was a tenacity to him that, you know, when he was your ally, as we saw there, could go toe-to-toe with anyone. By the way, it's just kind of striking as you play that audio, Greg, thinking that Ted Kennedy was the Democrats' point man in sexual harassment accusations. That's Bill Clinton wasn't available at that point. Look, I mean, Arlen Specter was you know, a lot of Republicans' least favorite person by the time he departed the Senate, departed pretty clearly on acrimonious terms with his party. But this was a guy who, we can safely say, was a dedicated public servant who just, you know, this was his life, going back to his days as district attorney in Philadelphia. And so, you know, as soon as the news broke yesterday that he had passed away, there were some folks on our side who felt the need to, you know, talk about how much they didn't like him. And, Greg, I look at stuff like that, and I remember thinking, you know, seeing these sort of things when Andrew Breitbart passed away earlier this year, and thinking, like, what does it get us to tell people how much we didn't like Arlen Specter at a moment like this? I mean, you know, we knew he was struggling with cancer, but this death still comes as a shock. People who liked him are in mourning, and I don't really see any benefit to saying, oh, Arlen Specter, what a terrible guy he was. You know, I mean, look, as with all human beings, he was a mix of good and bad, and there's nothing wrong with holding your tongue in the first 24 hours after a man passes, or as I, you know, I think you and I have tried to do here, remember him in totality,
right.
You know, the good parts and the bad parts, and you know, as you know, don't need to dwell on everything we couldn't stand about the guy. Like I said, this man was tenacious. I think we can safely say that this was a full career in the Senate, full of highs and lows, and you know, a lot of good people in Pennsylvania are in mourning today, and hopefully our you know, all his family and his friends find peace in the days and weeks and months to come.
I think that's right. The totality always. Cover the totality of the story. And you mentioned his tenacity. This was not his first battle with cancer. He beat it at least two or three times, as well as a major heart issue over the years. So he was definitely a fighter. On to Martini number three now. And first, Jim, of course, there was the reaction to Jim Lehrer hosting the first debate. I think in retrospect, we perhaps appreciate a little bit more the way he did it, although at times it seemed like he was out of his element. Then Martha Raddatz, we kind of chronicled that at the end of last week about how she was not exactly fair and intervened far too much in the debate than we would have liked. And now both campaigns are wringing their hands over Candy Crowley, saying that she will not be, and forget her exact words, an innocent bystander in this town hall format debate going to be happening tomorrow between Obama and Romney at Hofstra. Mostly it's supposed to be questions from the town hall audience, but she has said that she will engage, and both campaigns are saying that's not in the rules. So it may not be, and maybe it's important to call her attention to that, but this new trend, essentially, of pregame demonization of the moderator is getting pretty old pretty early.
It is. And we'll see what happens with Candy Crowley. I end up being pretty disappointed with Martha Raddatz, at least her tone and style, although I think her topics are pretty good. With this, and the, you know, there's some debate as to whether the town hall format really is all that useful for a presidential campaign. Greg, I don't know about you. I'll be wondering if Ponytail Guy comes back after the 1992 one. This is the guy who asked Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Ross Perot about the president as a national father figure. It was very kumbaya. Let's all hold hands, people. You know. So we don't know who we're going to get. It's at Hempstead, Long Island, Hofstra University. I'm kind of expecting Vinny on the car phone from WFAN Sports Radio to break in and ask him about Tebow versus Sanchez. You know. I suppose the idea of a moderator in these sorts of debates is kind of just to be a traffic cop, be timekeeper, make sure that things kind of, you know, flow clearly. I don't know. I mean, there are certain times where Raddatz seemed like she was doing interviews with the candidates before her and wanted to ask follow-ups and things like that. The thing people go to see is the president and his challenger. And I don't know if we necessarily go to see the moderator. And so I think it's very easy to overdo this. I'm not going to prejudge Candy Crowley. Some of these comments do seem a little bit ominous, but, you know, she's speaking off the cuff and trying to see. Well, the only thing you can do is just hope that Candy Crowley realizes this. It's not supposed to be about her. People aren't supposed to come out of it talking about her. I actually don't think Jim Lehrer was that bad. I mean, I think, you know, the whole point of this is just let the candidates interact with each other. Unless somebody goes the full Biden and just starts, you know, shouting at the other guy or something. Let the chips fall where they may. Let the candidates talk to each other and see how this turns out. And also try to keep the time relatively even. You know, it's ironic that, you know, Biden was using up more time last week and ended up having more time. He was complaining he wasn't getting enough time, even though he was outpacing Ryan pretty, you know, consistently throughout the entire evening. So hopefully Crowley will do a good job. I think it's very interesting. There's been so much hullabaloo over Raddatz and Lehrer. I wonder if it's kind of gotten into the heads of all the remaining moderators, this sense that they have to be active and vocal and you know, fact-checking and correcting them and combative and all these things. I don't think that's the role of the moderator. But, you know, I guess there's only two people who have choices in this from here on out. It's Candy Crowley and Bob Schaefer.
So we'll find out how it goes. We'll talk a little bit more about the debate in tomorrow's Three Martini Lunch. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you then.
Looking forward to it, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.